Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is the final episode of our series on American Indian mythology, to use the title that the book gives it. And what we're going to do today is we're going to do a wrap-up, kind of looking back at what we've been reading about over the past few months and talking about a figure that I sort of had wanted to see included in this section, and that's Glooskap. And for Glooskap, we can read a number of other Eastern cultural hero characters, but we'll talk about them in a moment. Let's begin by reviewing what we've covered as we looked at the Native American mythos section. At the beginning of this podcast and at the beginning of every season, I say something to the effect that I am not here to criticize Jim Ward or Rob Kuntz. My understanding is that Jim Ward is the primary author, and that Rob Kuntz's name is on the book largely because he worked on earlier versions of it, but I could be wrong about that. I speak subject to correction, but I believe Jim Ward is kind of the main force here. I'm not here to criticize Jim Ward for the quality of work that he was able to do with the resources available to him in the late 1970s. He's got a pretty limited range of sources available to him, and he just has to do the best he can with what he has. So normally, I don't want to be too overly critical of the authors here. On the other hand, this section could use some work. As I said at the beginning of the season, the Native American mythology section commits the three great errors of writing about Native American cultures. First, it treats Native American cultures, which are hugely diverse, as if they were one single thing. Thing number two is that it treats Native American culture as belonging to the past. Now, that is less of an issue in this section because, of course, this is a section that is not very concerned about history, but it is kind of present in the language of the introduction. And that's a very dangerous thing that occurs in the way that people write about Native American culture. They talk about it as if it were historical and not contemporary. These are stories that still have sacred meanings for Native American communities today. Not that every Native American person subscribes to these religious beliefs, of course, a lot of Native American Christians or atheists or whatever, but is different to talk about the Dine Bahane than it is to talk about the Iliad. That one is something that global culture engages with primarily as a work of literature, and one is something that is still a very active spiritual practice for a lot of people. Now, obviously there are Hellenic Reconstructionist pagans out there. I don't want to diminish that, but there is a difference. Thirdly and finally, and perhaps more importantly than the second point, the section presents a lot of, you know, stereotypes and common misconceptions about Native American culture. Indeed, it sometimes seems to take those misconceptions as its starting point and proceed from them. All that stuff about being close to nature or whatever. I don't think that stereotype is meant to be hurtful, which is something, again, that I've said before in this section. I don't think that any of these stereotypes are intended to be negative, but they are nonetheless stereotypes, and they reduce and overlook the complexity of Native American society. To compound this, the presentation of Native American mythology and religion in this section is not great. So we've seen examples of deities where they've clearly just been kind of based on some kind of encyclopedia entry. So, for instance, to go back just to a recent episode, Toba Jishine is a much more complex figure than the simplistic war god that is presented in his entry in Deities and Demigods. Indeed, the entry in Deities and Demigods has almost none of the characteristics of the mythological Toba Jishine. It almost feels like Jim Ward looked up an entry on this deity and it said, you know, Navajo war god, and he went, okay, well, what's a war god like? And unfortunately, that's not really what Toba Jishine is. Well, fortunately, I guess, that's not really what Toba Jishine is like. So it may be a case of, you know, Ward simply doing the best that he could with the resources that he had available to him. But, you know, here now in 2020, I think we can do a whole lot better. Indeed, this may be a case of the impossible thing coming down from above, right? I don't know whose idea it was to do a single section on Native American mythology. You know, maybe that was Jim Ward's idea, but maybe it's something that came down from Lawrence Schick or even from Gary Gygax, right? I don't know. So what we have here in many ways is a pantheon that is less than the sum of its parts. The individual entries for deities and mythological figures, with one or two exceptions, like the mysterious Kaguas, are really interesting, and hopefully they inspire reading that will, you know, teach you more about Native American culture and Native American mythology. That's certainly what happened with me. I didn't really know that much about this stuff. I still don't really know that much about this stuff, but I didn't really know anything about this stuff when I started. I just had a couple books on the subject that I knew I could dip into. But I think that in addition to the individual entries not cohering, there are many cases, I mentioned the example of Toba Jishine, where the book entry is less compelling than the mythological original and actually less suited to fantasy gaming, which feels like a real oversight. Now, perhaps this is partly because this is a section that may be unfamiliar to many readers. You know, there's not a lot of education in the American educational system, I say, having been through it, about Native American culture, or at least there wasn't in the school that I went to at the time that I went to it. Obviously, education varies from place to place, so it's hard to generalize, but I don't think that American students, for the most part, learn a great deal about Native American history or culture. Indeed, I've learned more teaching the Native American history section of the American History A-level than I ever did in the United States. And if you look at popular culture, people know more about, say, Zeus than they do about Hinnon, despite the fact that, you know, an active faith in Zeus is more remote in both time and space than one in Hinnon. People know a lot more about Zeus than they do about Hinnon, even if that's just from, like, Clash of the Titans or video games. Those images are ubiquitous in Western culture. You know, everybody knows who Hercules is. So our next section is going to be Greek mythology, and my guess would be that what we're going to find is entries that are not that much more detailed than the ones here, but where the effect is totally different because they occur within a context where the reader is already reasonably well educated about what these things are. You know, if you took Jane Dicebag or Johnny DMScreen and you said, tell me about Apollo or Hermes, like, I think they would be able to tell you a good amount. You know, maybe not for some deities more than others, but in general. And that's absolutely not the case here, except for maybe, like, Coyote and Raven. And even then, I bet those definitions wouldn't extend far beyond the phrase trickster figure. So you know a lot about Zeus, even if it's just from kids' books. You know, you'll know a lot about Thor, even if it's just from Marvel Comics, and you don't have that same frame of reference for Toba Jishine. Another issue, and one that I think is quite hard to define, is the question of, let's call it feel. You know, a lot of arguments about the setting of Dungeons & Dragons have cropped up over the last few years, you know, really since the release of 3rd edition with its kind of dungeon punk aesthetic. You know, some people feel that this is not properly D&D, and those sometimes devolve into arguments about what did and did not exist in the Middle Ages. And of course, those are countered by pointing out that D&D is not set in the Middle Ages, it's set in a fantasy world. In reality, this is an argument about aesthetics, about medieval aesthetics. It's not that, you know, we want our game to be a rigorously accurate historical simulation of medieval Europe, but that these people who are speaking are using that framework to discuss aesthetic preferences. They just like knights. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with liking knights. This is something that we've actually seen before in terms of monsters, in terms of wildlife. So if you're running a D&D campaign and it's constantly they're running into, like, alligators and grizzly bears and mountain lions, that feels weird because it feels North American. Some of those you can get away with, but, like, eventually all these rattlesnakes and things start to add up. I always use the example of the Song of Ice and Fire books, but it is really jarring in the Song of Ice and Fire books when you have this very European culture, and then you're periodically reminded that it's a European culture, but it's an American landscape full of redwood trees. In the field of medieval studies, we have this term medievalism. And what medievalism refers to are these images of the Middle Ages and how they appear in things that are not actually studies of medieval history. So, you know, how do people think about the Middle Ages and how do they present the Middle Ages in art or in entertainment or whatever? And I feel like the default medievalism of Dungeons & Dragons that's developing at this point in AD&D First Edition is not 100%. So if you look at Monster Manual, I think you'd be surprised. I think, well, you wouldn't as a listener of Monster Man, but I think the kind of casual late 80s, early 90s D&D player would be surprised at how classical it is, at how much non-medieval material there is, and how that's reflected in the illustrations. A lot of classical imagery in the illustrations, too, or even Hellenistic. But I feel like, in many ways, the Native American mythology fits awkwardly with the medieval aesthetics, even though there's no reason that it should, because obviously we are dealing with a completely fantastic setting and a completely fantastic version of that Native American pantheon. So there's no reason that this knight in medieval-like armor shouldn't be worshipping Hino, and yet it seems weird because of the mental associations that those two things have for us and how they don't quite line up with each other. And what that means is that when this type of material gets included in a D&D game, it's often in a place that is kind of outside the game's core setting, like Chult in Mastika's Greyhawk, and Chult is the Forgotten Realms, I guess. But those kinds of pseudo-American settings, because they are introduced into the game world as new places for the player characters to visit, immediately open themselves to those kind of colonialist approaches, right? Because what we have here are heroic adventurers from a pseudo-European setting coming to a pseudo-American setting and going around and taking gold from its shrines, which evokes the 15-teens and early 1520s in an uncomfortable way. So I think the way to avoid that is to have a setting that is grounded in that kind of Americanism rather than medievalism, which is something that most people aren't that interested in, and this section of the book would not really help you with. So in many ways, this is a section of Deities and Demigods that is not quite what you want it to be, and maybe it never could be. Now, that sounds negative, and it is, but on the whole, I do feel that there's useful and interesting material here. To be frank with you, the only part of this that I would take from, you know, this section is some of the stuff about the, you know, the Thunderbird and the Water Serpent and their rivalry. And, I, you know, I wouldn't phrase them necessarily in that exact way, but I love some of the stuff about Hino. I loved the idea of the god saving someone's life and then they therefore have to become one of that god's paladins. I think that's a really interesting sort of origin story for, like, the reluctant paladin, which is an unusual trope, right? Because paladins are supposed to be extremely devoted and fanatical, but the idea of someone who is discharging an obligation by, you know, taking up the sword in service of the faith, I think is a really fun one. And there are a few other things in there, you know. I like the idea of incorporating a coyote-like trickster, one who is less malevolent than a Loki sort of character, into a pantheon. I think that's fun, and goodness knows there's enough creatures that could serve such a being in the Monster Manual. You know, maybe that's who is behind all of these mischievous sprites. And I like the idea of the culture heroes, although again, I feel like maybe these are player character-y kind of characters, rather than beings that I would necessarily include in a pantheon that the player characters are intended to worship. So I wanted to close out by talking about one of the figures that I was surprised to see not included in this section, and that is Glooskap. Now, Glooskap is a little bit like some of the other characters that we've seen here. He's a little bit like Hiawatha, for example, particularly the Hiawatha of Longfellow's poem, who is not modeled on the historical Hiawatha, but maybe more modeled on a mythological figure called Nenobojo, who I'm probably mispronouncing that name. He is a culture hero who gives certain gifts, both social and technological, to his people. And Glooskap is the example of this among a number of different Native American nations, but particularly the Wabanaki. And if you read a lot of H.P. Lovecraft, like I expect some of my listeners do, those are the same people as the Abenaki who are mentioned in, I think, The Whisper in Darkness. They are a northeastern woodland Native American nation. And Glooskap appears in a number of different forms. And in one version, he's sort of like a Paul Bunyan figure, in that he creates a lot of, like, he's a giant and he creates a lot of landscape features. You know, oh, that's where Glooskap dug this hole to do this, and that's where Glooskap, you know. And specifically, he created Prince Edward Island to be his pillow when he laid down and slept. In other versions, he's more of a well-meaning but slightly clumsy trickster figure. And I actually really like this version of Glooskap because he teaches an important lesson for player characters. And I'm going to, because it's me, like if you're filling out the patron deities bingo, I'm going to compare this to Glorantha in a moment. Glooskap wants to help. He's a good, well-meaning sort of person. And so, for instance, he sees that humans are overfishing the rivers. They are hunting too many animals and they're fishing too much and they're going to deplete the populations of these rivers. As he goes to Grandmother Woodchuck, and Grandmother Woodchuck tells him all about this, and so he gets a big net and he goes down to the river and he puts all the animals in the river in his net and takes them away. And he's like, all right, now they're going to be safe. And Grandmother Woodchuck says, okay, but now the humans are going to die because they're not going to have anything to eat. You know, you have to put them back and, like, teach them to only eat some of the animals. And that's a pretty common pattern for these Glooskap stories, where Glooskap notices a problem, he implements a solution that's worse than the original problem, and then he has to kind of find a middle ground. And I think that one of the things that's so great about Glooskap is that a lot of his stories involve breaking things and then fixing them, which I think is a really valuable thing to have in D&D games. Because one of the things that player characters maybe have a tendency to do is hesitate for fear of messing things up. Maybe that hasn't been your experience. Maybe your player characters tend to boot in the door and go in blasting. Maybe I am just a very cautious player, but I think it's valuable to try and encourage an attitude where action is rewarded. That's how I was going to compare this to Glorantha, because in Glorantha, one of the central myths of the Orlanthi religion is the myth of the Lightbringer's Quest, where the sun god, Yelm, treats Orlanth unjustly. This is from the Orlanthi perspective. The Yelmic perspective is different. The sun god Yelm treats Orlanth unjustly, and so Orlanth kills him. So Yelm descends into the underworld, but while the sun is in the world is plunged into darkness and all kinds of bad things start to happen. Recognizing that he has made a mistake, Orlanth assembles a band of supporting deities, the so-called Lightbringers, and they descend into the underworld to rescue Yelm, and they come up with a compromise, and that is, of course, the compromise where the sun is above the earth half of the time and below it the rest of the time, right? But one of the central messages of the Orlanthi faith is, we are powerful. We can make mistakes, and then we can fix them. Acting now, goofing up, and then going ahead and fixing it is a very important part of that culture, and that's a very good player character example, in my opinion. Because we often encounter scenarios that are written such that they only work if the players behave in one specific way, or play cultures that, like, mock or belittle players for making mistakes. I remember once, it's actually not a game I ever even played in, but we created characters for this game, and I remember someone saying, like, this is not a very deadly game. If you die, it's probably because you were stupid. And I kind of thought to myself, like, I don't feel good about that. What if I just am playing a character who's reckless and aggressive, and I get killed as a consequence of my own actions? You know, maybe that's something to be celebrated. And I'm as guilty as anyone else of being critical like that, and it's something I kind of try to overcome in myself. But I like that Glooskap, as an example to player characters, is this guy who tries to help, goofs up, and then tries again. I think that's a good perspective for an adventurer. He fights for the common good and screws up a lot. And he also invented canoes, fishing nets, tobacco, and a bunch of other stuff. A resourceful guy, Glooskap. Okay, that is about all the mythology that we have time for today. In our next series of patron deities, we're going to be moving on to the Greek mythos section. And I know I didn't do the usual poll where I asked people, and that's because I wanted to do a section where I knew I had the sources available to me, since under the current circumstances, I'm not going to be getting out to the library very much. And I thought, you know, I'd been saving sort of an obvious one. Although it's not as obvious as you think it is, but I've been saving, you know, a quote-unquote easy one for a while, just in case I ever needed a break. I don't think it's going to be a break, but it's going to be a different kind of effort, let's put it that way. So we're going to be beginning our overview of the Greek mythos section in our next episode of Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.